This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
This man says he and other protesters won't stop their actions until Zuma's freed. The old man's being treated like a dog, he tells VOA.
That's Darren Taylor reporting on South African riots. Details coming up also. The UN human rights chief calls for measures to end systemic racism against people of African descent. All these and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. At least six people have died and more than 200 have been arrested after violence broke out in several parts of South Africa this weekend. Protesters are demanding that former President Jacob Zuma be released from prison. The army has been called out of Gauteng and KwaZulu-Natal provinces to quell the violence. The country's constitutional court recently sentenced Zuma to 15 months in jail for refusing to answer questions at a commission of inquiry into corruption. Zuma began serving his sentence at a prison in his home province of KwaZulu-Natal on Friday morning. As Darren Taylor reports, his incarceration has sparked celebration and anger in South Africa.
A policeman fires rubber bullets at people looting a store in central Johannesburg. Some of them are wearing yellow t-shirts imprinted with the insignia of the ruling African National Congress, the ANC, and an image of a smiling Jacob Zuma. This man says he and other protesters won't stop their actions until Zuma's freed. The old man's being treated like a dog, he tells VOA, claiming Zuma's been imprisoned without trial. His fellow demonstrators say they want to bring the economy to its knees to punish the government for throwing their euro into jail. City police spokesman Wayne Minor says groups claiming to be pro-Zuma protesters have blocked highways with rocks and burning tires. Some have shot at cars.
The M2 is still closed to traffic because of the possibility of passing vehicles being shot at. There was also the looting. It's violent. We also had vehicles torched. Dealerships, people who sell motor vehicles were torched on the premises.
Superintendent Minar says at least one person is dead and scores have been injured in South Africa's biggest city. One policeman was shot and is recovering in hospital. Police have arrested more than 60 people. The spokesman for Jacob Zuma's foundation, Mzwanele Manyi, has not condemned the violence that's happening in his boss's name. He says it's happening because reasonable South Africans know the former president's being treated disgracefully.
What we see happening on the ground is a righteous anger to all these injustices. As we sit here and now, President Zuma, a 79-year-old pensioner, is sitting in a cold cell. His health is being negatively affected by this, both physically and psychologically.
Correctional Services says Zuma's health is being cared for and he's safe and is undergoing an assessment to make sure he's free of COVID-19. Many citizens and legal experts have pointed out it was Zuma who chose to go to prison rather than giving evidence at a corruption inquiry. He allegedly helped to steal billions of dollars from state-owned enterprises when he led South Africa between 2009 and 2018. The Constitutional Court found him in contempt of court for not testifying and ordered him to prison. Manyi says anyone condemning the violence as criminal thuggery is guilty of selective morality.
The foundation is very clear that the biggest outrage should be to the Concord for unleashing this on us. The Concord acted inconsistent with the law. The Concorde has meted a punitive committal when there was an option of a coercive committal. So indeed, what we have here is a result of what the Concorde has done.
In KwaZulu-Natal, Zuma supporters barricaded highways near the city of Durban and petrol bombed trucks. Inkatha Freedom Party leader Velinkosi Hlabisa blames Zuma sympathizers within the ruling party in the province for the violence.
It is not just ordinary people or unknown people who are causing this havoc in our economy, destabilizing the province. Are the people who are ANC members, they are wearing ANC regalia, they are known within the structures of the ANC.
Zuma's asked the Constitutional Court to rescind its decision to jail him for contempt of court. The judges are hearing the case today. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The coordinator of the UN support mission in Libya has said the Libyan Political Dialogue Forum on Friday failed to agree on constitutional terms for the December elections, leaving the prospect of effective polls in question. The head of the High Council of State, Khalid al-Misri, said the UN support mission in Libya and the international community are pressuring negotiators to allow military officials to run in the upcoming elections. Wolfgang Pochtai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed the developments with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
There are huge differences between the various factions in the LPDF. Actually, in fact, it seems to be there are unbridgeable divides between them. One faction insists on having elections in December in accordance with the LPDF roadmap, the Berlin II conference, UNSMIL and the international community. Others, mainly Islamists and Islamist-leaning LPDF members, who are aware of the current weakness of the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamists in elections in Libya so far, they want to delay the elections as much as possible because they want to maintain their current position, force their grip on the state, and they can live with the current situation very well. Their tool is the demand for a referendum about the draft constitution. They claim that this would be possible before the elections in December, which is absolutely not realistic. Others believe that state building, namely the implementation of a permanent constitution, should take place before the election, accepting that this would delay the elections for a longer time. This is certainly a good argument, but the question is what is more important right now. So obviously, there is no compromise possible between having elections in December or not having elections.
The head of the High Council of State, Khaled al-Misri, said that the UN support mission in Libya and the international community are pressuring them to allow military officials to run in the upcoming elections. He said conditions for candidates in the upcoming elections must be logical and cannot be made to fit a certain person. Can you explain what he is referring to?
Al-Misri has said in an interview that this refers not only to LNA commander Khalifa Haftar, but also to all other military, like the Libyan Army Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Mohammed al-Haddad, who is from Misrata, and the Western Military Region Commander, Major General Osama Shweli, who is from Sindan. But obviously, and it's very clear that his main concern is not al-Haddad from Misrata, but Khalifa Haftar. Al-Misri said already before that we, and he is probably referring to the Islamists, would never ever accept the result of the elections if Haftar wins them. He said that they would oppose him by force, which would mean that this is an announcement of war if Haftar runs and would win the elections. Haftar himself did not make any announcements that he intends to run. But in the Cyrenaica, there are some influential tribes who asked him already to candidate. I guess that Haftar will only run for the elections if he's almost sure that he will win. And this is not, let's say, not very likely. Otherwise, and this is much more likely, he will probably support another candidate who has his personal confidence.
U.S. Ambassador to Libya, Richard Norland, accused many members of the Libyan Political Dialogue Forum of trying to prolong the constitutional process to prevent holding the elections on time or creating new conditions for it. What does that mean?
He probably talks about Abdurrahman Shweli, Ali Dabeiba, and others in the LPDF. but also about the High Council of State Chair Khalid al-Mishri and other Islamists who demand, as said, that the constitution referendum needs to be before the elections. Norland is absolutely correct with his statement, as it is extremely unlikely that the faulty and weak draft of the constitution would get the required majority in all three of Libya's historic provinces. But even if, the elections would be delayed for several months for technical reasons. After the expected rejection of the draft, it would be necessary to reopen and rework on the draft. And thereafter, there would be again a referendum. One needs to remember that the Constitutional Drafting Assembly needed already more than 3 years to get to the first draft. So one could expect a very long delay of the elections if the referendum approach is chosen.
That was Wolfgang Porstai, a former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with my colleague Mohammed Al-Shinawi. UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet is calling for action and concrete measures to end systemic racism and racial violence against Africans and people of African descent. The High Commissioner has presented a series of recommendations to address these problems in a report to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet is calling for action and concrete measures to end systemic racism and racial violence against Africans and people of African descent. The High Commissioner has presented a series of recommendations to address these problems in a report to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva. Text in 321. The report was mandated by the Council a year ago in the aftermath of the killing of African-American George Floyd while in police custody in the U.S. state of Minnesota. High Commissioner Bachelet calls Floyd's murder a tipping point. She says it has shifted the world's attention to the human rights violations routinely endured by Africans and people of African descent. The report provides a comprehensive view of the inequalities, marginalization, and lack of opportunities that render many people of African descent powerless, trapped in poverty, and victimized by a system of social injustice. The report focuses on lethal incidents at the hands of law enforcement. Bachelet says her office has received information about at least such 190 deaths of Africans and people of African descent. She notes 98% have occurred in Europe, Latin America, and North America. She says there's been a strikingly consistent failure to see justice done in all these cases.
Three key contexts in which police-related fatalities stood out: the policing of minor offenses, traffic stops, and stop and searches. The intervention of law enforcement officials as first responders in mental health crisis and special police operation in the context of the war on drugs or gang-related operations. Moreover, law enforcement officers are rarely held accountable for human rights violations and crimes against persons of African descent.
The killing of George Floyd is a rare exception. Police officer Derek Chauvin, whose brutal murder of Floyd was captured on video and witnessed by millions, was found guilty of his crime and sentenced to more than 20 years in prison. In a video statement, Floyd's brother Felonious says he still feels the horrific pain of watching his brother pass away.
He was tortured to death. In broad daylight, that was a modern-day execution. It's difficult knowing that you can run from the police and they still will shoot you in the back with no weapon. You don't have any weapon, but at the same time, they still get qualified immunity.
Considering these profound and wide-ranging injustices, High Commissioner Bachelet says there is an urgent need to confront the legacies of enslavement and to seek reparatory justice. Her recommendations include acknowledging the systemic nature of racism to transform the structures. They call for holding law enforcement officials accountable for crimes, guaranteeing the right of freedom of expression and peaceful assembly during anti-racism protests, and taking steps to address the harms caused through a wide range of reparations measures. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Rights groups in Zimbabwe are expressing concern about vulnerable groups after authorities imposed a new strict lockdown to curb a spike in coronavirus infections. The restrictions come as Zimbabwe's numbers of confirmed infections has more than doubled in the past week. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
Rights groups in Zimbabwe are expressing concern about vulnerable groups after authorities imposed a new strict lockdown to curb a spike in coronavirus infections. The restrictions come as Zimbabwe's number of confirmed infections has more than doubled in the past week. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare for VOA News. Text. Monica Mchangwa, Zimbabwe's information minister, told reporters late Tuesday that a recent spike in COVID-19 cases has forced authorities to impose tighter restrictions. Officials had already imposed a nighttime curfew last week.
Exemption mechanisms, which was used during the first lockdown in 2020, will be reactivated with immediate effect. This will certainly reinforce the current efforts of containing the spread of COVID-19. Stiffer penalties will be imposed for violations of COVID-19 restrictions, including the withdrawal of operating licenses. As you might be aware, the entire country is now under level 4 lockdown.
Samuel Wadzai is the head of Zimbabwe Vendors Initiative for Social and Economic Transformation. He says his group opposes the reintroduction of exemption letters that only allow essential workers, such as police and government employees, to reach their jobs.
We just hope that it's going to be instituted in a transparent manner. In the past, we have seen these exemption letters being used to block the operations of informal traders. So it is our hope that there will be a clear communication in terms of where people in the informal economy will get the letters, and there will be enough measures to ensure that one gets these letters in a manner that does not promote corruption.
Mchangwa said the government is also intensifying its vaccination program as part of an effort to contain the global pandemic. About 810,000 Zimbabweans out of a population of 14 million have received their first shot, and about 575,000 have received their second inoculation since the program started in February. Dewa Mavinga is the head of Human Rights Watch in Southern Africa. He says the government should concentrate on vaccinating the adult population and essential workers instead of tightening lockdown regulations.
This is to get the wrong end of the stick, because this will not in a big way address the real challenges. And the government is focused on a heavy-handed response that is not suitable for the Zimbabwean context, particularly when you look at the vast majority of Zimbabweans who live in poverty, who depend on the informal economy for their livelihoods, and who have no way to get the so-called exemption letters with which to travel, go about their lives. And we also know that the government of Zimbabwe is not supporting these people in terms of intervention packages.
Last year, the government said it was giving about $10 to each family a month affected by lockdown regulations. On Wednesday, most vendors did not take heed of the government's call to stay at home unless they have exemption letters. One of them is Lucia Mutetwa, who sells second-hand clothes. She says, "I only see corruption increasing because of these letters, because everyone wants to go somewhere with an exemption letter or not. This only gives police an advantage. They will start demanding bribes as they were doing during the last time during the lockdown," says Mutetwa. Zimbabwe has 56,014 confirmed coronavirus infections and 1,939 deaths, according to Johns Hopkins University, which tracks the global outbreak. The numbers have more than doubled in the last few weeks. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
The Nigerian government's efforts to reintegrate former Boko Haram militants has seen hundreds of fighters go through rehabilitation, but it also gets pushback from the conflict victims who want the militants to be held accountable. At a conference in the capital, women from the conflict-affected areas are getting support to head up reconciliation between the former terrorists and their communities, as Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Some 45 women from Nigeria's northeastern states of Borno, Adamawa and Yobe file in for a two-day conference in Abuja. They're here to discuss a sensitive subject, the reconciliation and reintegration of ex-Boko Haram fighters into their communities. The conference is a joint initiative by the non-profit Center for Humanitarian Dialogue in Switzerland, UN Women, and the International Organization for Migration, IOM. It's designed to promote women-led community peacekeeping in the Northeast, says Millicent Lewis Ujumu, director at Center for Humanitarian Dialogue.
We know and from experience have seen that when the women are involved in the conversations, in peace building, in helping to resolve issues relating to how to integrate and rehabilitate former combatants or persons associated with Boko Haram, that they are very effective.
Since launching the Safe Exit Program, Operation Safe Corridor, for repentant fighters in 2016, authorities say the program has met with resistance from host communities. The scheme was launched as part of a growing awareness for the use of amnesty to persuade terrorists to lay down their guns. Nearly 1,000 ex-fighters have been rehabilitated under the government's program. But very few are successfully living in communities. Most of them eventually rejoin Boko Haram due to rejection. Hamzatu Alamin is one of the participants of the conference. She started talking about reconciliation 10 years ago when her community was hit hard and young men were coerced into joining Boko Haram. But she says her efforts attracted some unwanted attention.
You can be arrested by the state actors and then being an accused of being an accomplice. And then secondly, the boys too, if you make a mistake, you can be their target too.
Women like Alamin here say they hope to improve their community's acceptance of former jihadists after the conference. But attending the conference along with other women also lifts the burden of being negatively labeled with terrorists.
I have been communicating with them, and then I'm happy now I'm able to say it really, because I know even the government is communicating with them. The government and security forces are using many of the boys I communicate with as outlets to get the people they are rehabilitating.
Maria Quintero, program manager at IOM Nigeria, says women also need socio-economic stability if the program is to succeed.
The Nigerian women are very strong. What we have found as well is that they are very influential in the decision of the males. Women have a role to play, and especially when it comes to the males coming back to the communities.
More than 35,000 people have been killed and millions displaced since the start of the Boko Haram insurgency in 2009. Boko Haram, which opposes Western education, has frequently targeted schools. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.